This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian.
In this hour, in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court decision that weakened the EPA's capacity to protect wetlands, we'll explore the role of wetlands in sustainability, biodiversity, and the economy. What might this decision mean for our environment and our economy? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Since the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972, the Environmental Protection Agency has administered the insurance of clean water in the United States. Many of the projects that the EPA administers are projects where they work closely with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in this implementation. And one of these areas these two agencies, these two government organizations have protected have been wetlands. But what are wetlands protections and how are they covered under the Clean Water Act? How much impact does this legislation have on corporations or individuals wishing to build in a way that could potentially threaten wetlands? On this year's Supreme Court docket, the court heard a case called Sackett versus EPA. And in this case, the protection of wetlands were pretty significantly curtailed, and the EPA was weakened in its protection of these wetlands. So on today's show, we'll explore the history of wetlands protections, what this case means for environmental law, what this case means mostly for environmental policy, environmental economics, and broadly for EPA authority to take action in the implementation of legislation like the Clean Water Act. Our panel today is David Kaiser. He's professor in the Department of Resource Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the co-author of The Low But Uncertain Measured Benefits of U.S. Water Quality Policy and Consequences of the Clean Water Act and the Demand for Water Quality, and also The Economic Effects of Environmental Crisis, Evidence from Flint, Michigan. And Richard Pete Andrews, who is faculty fellow of the Institute for the Environment and Professor Emeritus in the Department of Public Policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of Managing the Environment, Managing Ourselves, A History of American Environmental Policy. Thank you both very much for joining us. I'll start with you, David Kaiser. The Sackett versus EPA case that came forward, what exactly was that about?
First of all, thanks so much for having me, Doug. Appreciate being here. So the Sackett case is one of the most important cases related to the federal reach of the Clean Water Act. And this was, I believe, the first case that the Supreme Court heard this last term. And it was recently decided, as you mentioned, in May of this year. And it did curtail or significantly narrow the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. And to understand the Sackett case, it goes back to, I think, around 2004, 2005, a couple I believe it was Chantel and Michael Sackett, purchased a vacant lot on Priest Lake in northern Idaho with the intent to develop that land. And so a few years later, when they went to develop that land and to build a home on that land, I believe that was in 2007, shortly after getting permits for that land, my understanding is that EPA then came to the Sacketts and said that they were actually developing a wetland. And the Clean Water Act, which is the main federal environmental statute which governs surface water quality in the United States, protects wetlands. And in order to then try to develop that land, the Sacketts actually needed a permit to build on that land. And the Sacketts decided to challenge EPA's designation as they believed that that was a wetland. And so this went through a pretty lengthy litigation. And my understanding is that actually the Sackett case first was heard before the Supreme Court in 2012 for the first time as to whether or not the Sacketts could even challenge EPA's designation of a wetland. Again, this is my broad understanding of the case. And then it has slowly made its way back through the courts and has now come before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decided with the Sacketts in a unanimous decision that the property that the Sacketts own was not considered under the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. And then in addition to that, the majority opinion has significantly narrowed the definition of what it means to be a waters of the United States or what waters are currently under the jurisdiction of the Clean Water.
And so, Pete Andrews, it seems like the court could have decided fairly narrowly that this land isn't wetlands or isn't covered under the Clean Water Act. But the court did something much bigger than that and actually narrowed what constitutes wetlands and the actual power of the EPA. Is this kind of consistent with some of the challenges the EPA has, you know, has faced, legal challenges weakening their ability to administer the Clean Water Act, particularly in the last number of years?
Well, this goes back a ways, so let me take a couple of minutes to really do a little deeper dive into history. I mean, before 1970, wetlands, by and large, starting with the Swamplands Act of 1849, most American policy toward wetlands was toward encouraging the development and, you know, the filling and development of swamps. And the Swamplands Act were quite notorious. They were abused in many ways, but they basically encouraged, you know, the building of levees along the Mississippi and reclaiming all that land that was there. They were swamps. They were, you know, filled with mosquitoes. They were wasteland and so forth. So it was really only in the 1970s and since then that we've suddenly realized, and with the rise of the field of ecology, that these so-called swamps were properly renamed wetlands and then were a particular kind of ecosystem that provides really important values, including water purification, habitat for fish hatcheries, you know, for fish to breed, habitat for waterfowl, migratory waterfowl, and so forth. There's a little bit of background before that in trying to protect the migratory waterfowl themselves, and a gradual recognition that to do that, you needed not just to regulate hunting, but also to protect their habitat. So this goes back a ways. And in I think it was 1977, the amendments to the Clean Air Act set up the framework for the EPA for the Corps of Engineers to require permits for wetland filling, and the Clean Water Act for discharge of pollutants into waters of the U.S., including wetlands adjacent to them. So that's the deep background of our gradual realization that by the 1980s, we had lost something like 50% of the nation's historic wetlands. And we're still losing them, about 11,000 acres a year or so. Don't quote me on that, but it was a significant losses of wetlands every year. And several presidents promised to stop that. To George H.W. Bush, the senior President Bush, promised no net loss of wetlands on his watch. Clinton, G.W. Bush, Obama, Biden all have tried to control the loss of wetlands, but it's beginning with a couple of earlier decisions. The court had begun to narrow the EPA's authority over wetlands. First of those decisions was one called Swansea, S-W-A-N-C-C, is the solid waste authority of one of the counties in Illinois, where EPA was trying to use the wetlands authority to protect a wetland that had become one because it was an abandoned mine pit that has become habitat for wildlife. And Supreme Court ruled at that point that that was a bridge too far. That was an isolated wetland. It had no connection to the quote unquote waters of the United States. And so that was, you know, certainly protecting wildlife was a good idea, but that there was not constitutional authority for EPA to regulate in that case. So then along came a second decision known as Rapinos. I don't remember all the particulars of it, but it resulted in a very divided Supreme Court decision in which Justice Scalia took the lead and wrote the main opinion and took something of a dictionary definition of waters that were adjoining waters of the United States, and that was the limits. And although Justice Kennedy wrote a broader version of that, which became the dominant opinion relied on by the Corps and the EPA, which said that the EPA's authority should also include wetlands that had a quote-unquote significant nexus with waters of the United States, so that these waters would, it was broader authority to regulate wetlands that were somehow connected to the water, but not necessarily with a direct surface connection to it, that they affected its water quality, cleansing properties, and other kinds of values of the waters of the United States.
That Swansea case, I want to bring David Kaiser into this. My understanding is the reason why that was such a significant case is that the county wanted to use it basically as a, you know, as a waste dump. Mm-hmm. And so ties into some of the economics questions, because a lot of times this gets framed as, you know, wetlands protection versus some sort of, you know, economic development. You know, Pete Andrews described that as, you know, this interest in draining the swamps was partially, you know, health related, but a lot of it, hey, that's land that we could actually probably use, you know, mm-hmm. and develop. So David, how much is there a tension between economic development, economic interest in developing these areas and in wetlands protection?
That's a great question. So from the economics perspective of thinking about wetlands, you certainly have what you described as the cost of not developing that wetland. Right? So it's the opportunity cost of not being able to use that wetland, say to either use it for a waste dump like you described, or to develop a home, or for agricultural use or other uses. However, when you think about, those are the costs, but economists oftentimes try to then weigh the cost of actions versus the benefits. So the benefits of protecting wetlands, as Pete mentioned earlier, are pretty diverse and wide ranging. So these are things, uses including habitat for aquatic species, as well as birds. They're used in recreation. They provide aesthetic values. There are also significant flood control benefits associated with wetlands, and as well as spiritual and cultural values more broadly. And the difficulty arises in the sense that the cost of not developing that wetland are very prominent, in the sense that this is incurring a private landholder will be incurring those costs of not being able to develop their land. However, the benefits of wetland protection are oftentimes what are known as the public goods of wetland protection. So these are goods that are not necessarily just accrued by the private landowner, but by society at large. And we know that public good, the provision of public goods oftentimes is underfunded, because these are goods that society at large can enjoy in, but then would be incentivized to not necessarily contribute to trying to provide for those public goods. And so you have this tension between oftentimes the costs being incurred by that private landowner, whereas the benefits could be enjoyed more broadly from a societal perspective. And so that oftentimes economics or economists would say that that's setting the stage for some kind of government intervention or regulation for the protection of something like wetlands themselves.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing wetlands protection and the impact of Sackett versus EPA with David Kaiser of UMass Amherst and Pete Andrews of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Pete, at one level, that question, I appreciate David calling it a good question, but many environmentalists think that's a terrible question, because the idea that we're engaging in a kind of cost-benefit analysis with respect to protecting the environment is in contrast to whether we have a responsibility to protect the environment for its own sake, you know, the so-called precautionary principle versus cost-benefit analysis. How much typically, you know, from a policy perspective, have this environmental principle of we should protect the environment for its own sake predominated in places like the EPA, or is the cost-benefit analysis still pretty much the way that we tend to view these issues?
Well, the whole questions of protecting things for moral reasons or aesthetic reasons or whatever is lies really at the heart of a lot of people's practical sense of the issues. I mean, it's that versus, you know, farmers, developers, other people who want to make personal economic use of these lands, or even state, you know, uses in the case of the Swamplands Act back in the 19th century and so forth. Both those arguments come together. Where the economics has developed in recent years, really in the last half century of the environmental era is in recognizing that there are economic arguments as well. So it's really aimed at neutralizing this assumption that the issue is environment versus economics, that it's jobs versus the environment and so forth, these kinds of things that come up. And you know, if you do the public sector economics of it and think about the benefits to society versus the cost to society, it creates a different narrative about the actual economic use while still realizing that, you know, much of the time what we really want is an environment where we've saved nature and really practically saved the functions that nature provides. There is a whole economy of nature that on which our civilization relies. That's a quick take on it.
David, I'm going to ask you the same question. Is the cost-benefit analysis the best way to view wetlands protection?
Good question. Again, I guess I'll answer that by also saying that I teach a class in the economics of water policy at UMass Amherst. And one of the first things that I tell my students is that economics is one piece of the puzzle, but not the entire answer for the puzzle. And I think that economics can provide a really informative, important piece of environmental policy. Now, when you think about, I think oftentimes the narrative is that economics would say that we should, or the public kind of maybe opinion of economics with the environment is that Pete says, maybe there's this narrative of economics versus the environment or the economy versus the environment. And I don't view it that way. I mean, oftentimes what we're tasked with as economists is to try to do a good job of actually measuring all of the oftentimes difficult to measure benefits that arise from environmental protection. And when we have done this, we have oftentimes found benefits that are much larger than the costs of regulation across a number of different types of environmental policies and regulations in the United States. And just to throw this number out there, there was a really well done recent study by Charles Taylor and Hannah Drunken-Miller, both environmental economists, looking at the economic implications or the economic benefits of wetlands as they relate to flood control. And I believe they find somewhere along the order of about the benefits that wetlands provide in the United States, something along $1 to $3 trillion. And this is a significant, and this is just in flood control benefits. And so it's a very large number, very significant economic benefit. And again, if I remember their study correctly, they find that oftentimes the benefits then of wetland protections can offset their costs. They do find variation in those benefits across the United States. Sometimes those benefits, I believe, are about four times larger near developed areas than in non-developed areas or less developed areas. But again, that argument would be, you could view that then as a very strong argument from an economics perspective for even more stringent wetland protection.
I'm going to follow up on that. Actually, Pete, go ahead and I'll follow up.
If it wouldn't Please. Interrupt your narrative too much, I wanted to get us back a couple of aspects of this decision that are important here.
Absolutely.
One of them is the it's a question of what are the waters of the United States, and how does that affect this discussion? And Justice Alito, who wrote this decision, noted in the decision that we used to leave it to the states. They can protect the wetlands, and yet. I'm from North Carolina, where Eastern North Carolina is substantial numbers of wetlands. I mean, we're not the biggest. I think Louisiana may be the biggest state for wetlands, but we've got a lot of wetlands there. And what this decision does is it says that only wetlands that have a direct connection to waters of the United States are subject to EPA jurisdiction. It removes EPA decisions, for example, from Pocosins, which are sort of perched wetlands. There are a lot of them in eastern North Carolina and Maryland and so forth. Carolina Bay is another one. And in the west, what they call vernal pools. All these are sort of ruled not part of EPA's jurisdiction anymore. And unfortunately, the North Carolina legislature has just passed legislation itself that then says, okay, North Carolina is going to handcuff itself to the federal regulations and say that the North Carolina authorities, the DEQ, will not be allowed to regulate beyond EPA's definition. So they're essentially handcuffing their state agencies to prevent them from taking up the responsibility that Justice Alito alluded to and looking themselves at what's important. I mean, we had hurricanes recently that came through, and where we had enormous flooding, not just from the seaside with the tidal waves, but then big floods, you know, heavy rainstorms inland. So the coastal cities got a double whammy of water coming up the rivers and coming down the rivers. And so to think right now of reducing the coverage of wetlands, that one of whose main functions is flood control and absorption of water closer to where it hits the ground, is folly.
And then I imagine, I mean, from a financial perspective, from an economic perspective, you're talking about maybe you gain a little something by building on the wetlands or draining the wetlands, but the amount that costs as a result of floods, as a result of damage control, you know, FEMA costs and the costs of rebuilding would be quite substantial. So it might be fair to frame this as short-term costs now versus long-term costs that could be quite more excessive if the wetlands are destroyed. Is that fair?
Now, they may not just be long-term. They may be quite short-term. These hurricanes are coming, you know, come on an unpredictable basis now.
No, absolutely. David, do you have some thoughts on that question as well? Is the way we frame the economics question?
Yeah, I think that just going back to what Pete said as well, and thinking about how states will respond to what's happened here, there are a couple of interesting things from an economics perspective. One is wetlands and the benefits that people get from wetlands, as well as, I mean, we haven't even talked about other things like intermittent and ephemeral streams, which may also be impacted from this ruling. The benefits that that society gets from having those water resources are not constrained to state boundaries. And again, this is the idea of thinking about the benefits that accrue from these water resources as public goods. These are not going to be things that are necessarily going to be just public goods within North Carolina or public goods within a small city. These are benefits that accrue across state lines. And there was a really nice previous report that EPA had done on the connectivity of water resources that was used in the Obama administration to talk a little bit more about thinking about how these water resources do then provide nexus or hydrologically and ecologically connected. And so again, it's something that since these water resources are connected, since many people other than just the private landowner will receive benefits, when we think about the economic benefits of what's happening or the economics of what's happening here, again, you have a narrow focus on the private cost of landowners while ignoring the larger public benefits that are accruing from the protection of these water resources. And I found it, and I'm not a legal scholar, of course. I should make sure, I probably should have said that from the beginning. I'm an environmental economist, but one of the things I found interesting in reading the opinions from the court was there had been, I believe in Alito's writing, a very much language around the cost to landowners associated with this process of having wetlands delineated and permitted and the fines that could be incurred by homeowners. But there was no mention, as far as what I could really see or jump out, in terms of the benefits. So again, it's a very narrow focus on the economics, not so much on the benefit side, on the cost, not so much on the benefit side.
Just want to follow up quickly. You mentioned intermittent and ephemeral streams. Did I get that phrase correct?
That's correct. So again,
what does that mean?
Yeah, so intermittent and ephemeral streams are, you can think of these as, so I should also preface this by saying I'm not an ecologist either, but my understanding from working on these issues is that intermittent and ephemeral streams are going to be bodies of water or streams that may only flow during certain times of year or after certain rainfall events. And these are particularly important in the West. And I haven't seen yet, and I think this will be interesting to see how EPA interprets the Sackett case, what the opinions in the Sackett case mean for intermittent and ephemeral streams, it looks like as we kind of move back to a more narrow reading of the waters of the United States, that there will also be a pullback on regulation that focuses on intermittent and ephemeral streams, because these are not going to have that kind of permanence that Alito referred to in his opinion for the court.
That's actually an interesting question, because you mentioned the West, and in the West, these streams are very much a large part of the water system of the West. And I mean, I can't remember what one of the cities in Colorado, the at some times of the year, the entire flow of the stream goes through their wastewater treatment plant. And so to take them out of this would be a huge decision. And so I would expect that the EPA and the Corps would probably try to continue to fight an interpretation that those are not part of the waters of the United States.
Interesting.
If I think back all the way to the origins of the idea of navigable waters, how did that become the defining thing? I mean, waters are different from air in the sense that they flow over private property before they get into, you know, streams. They flow over everything. You know, the rain falls everywhere. So you get private property versus streams, the navigable waters. This dates from the earliest years of the country, where the courts decided that the federal government should have jurisdiction over navigable waters, because the big inland rivers of the East Coast were the highways of commerce. And now commerce at that time realized that this did not mean just big ships. Commerce at that time meant trappers' canoes, and it meant logs floating down to mills and so forth. So it even in its earliest manifestations, navigable waters included a lot of, you know, relatively small waters. And then more broadly, EPA and the Corps and others began eliding this navigable waters into this somewhat broader and more flexible term, the waters of the United States, which included, you know, at least some wetlands, waters that were connected to, even if they weren't navigable themselves. But now the battle in this case has been about, okay, how far inland does waters of the United States go when it becomes a matter of EPA and the Corps of Engineers requiring people to get permits for housing developments, shopping centers, and farms? And that's what the real battle is about. It's many of these laws are written into farm bills, which have, of course, a very powerful constituency arguing for them to limit EPA's jurisdiction, and particularly from developers as well, who want to develop along watercourses, which is a popular place to live.
Just adding on to what Pete has said as well, I mean, Pete's given a really great background on this, but you know, one of the things that was just mind-blowing to me as I'm learning about a lot of these things, or when I was learning about a lot of these things for the first time, and when I talk about these issues in my class, is that we have the Clean Water Act, which is kind of the main federal environmental statute governing water quality in the United States. And we have a very vague notion of what it even covers, or what water resources fall underneath it. And again, this goes to what Pete had mentioned, but the Clean Water Act itself says that we control the discharge of pollution into navigable waters. And then Congress really only defined navigable waters as the waters of the United States. And so you're kind of left with, I almost felt like they should have said, navigable waters is waters of the United States, duh. You know, like everybody should know what that means. And of course, not everybody knows what that means. And then of course, that vagueness has led to decades of litigation and a number of Supreme Court cases that described earlier in the program.
When we come back, what will happen to our wetlands and the services they provide in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court decision to weaken the EPA's protection of them? Stay with us.
is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
Wetlands are a key part of the planet's ecology and sustainability. What might happen to them with the weakening of the Environmental Protection Agency in the Supreme Court's decision, Sackett versus EPA? And what other ramifications may come of the decision? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. We're examining the Supreme Court decision, Sackett versus EPA, in a really broader context of what this means for the implementation of the Clean Water Act. What exactly does the waters of the United States mean? And again, broadly about the role of the Environmental Protection Agency in environmental protection, particularly at a time when politically it serves as a lightning rod broadly against environmental protection, especially as framed as the EPA being against economic development. Our panel today is David Kaiser. He's a full professor in the Department of Resource Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and Richard Pete Andrews, who's a faculty fellow of the Institute for the Environment and professor emeritus in the Department of Public Policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Pete, I'm actually going to start with a very specific question that has always piqued my interest, because I know that the EPA works with the Army Corps of Engineers in the administration of the Clean Water Act. What exactly is the relationship between the two? Is one of them more of a lead agency and a second implementing it? What is the relationship between the EPA and the Army Corps?
Well, in this particular case is much more true than for many other environmental laws. The EPA has pretty direct authority to implement the Clean Air Act, for example. In the case of water, it goes back to the ancient law, the 1899 Refuse Act, which prohibited discharge of waste material into navigable waterways, and which was really a Corps of Engineers function. EPA didn't exist back then, but the Corps of Engineers was initially to keep, make people maintain their docks so you didn't have debris in the water that would threaten shipping. But over time, that has been more broadly interpreted, particularly with some decisions in the 1960s, saying that it includes pollution as well as just industrial waste and debris and so forth. So the Corps of Engineers was given authority under the Clean Water Act, Section 404, just for the nerds out there who want to look that up, which said they have authority to give permits for any discharge of waste into navigable waters, into the waters of the United States, ultimately. And EPA was given authority to review and advise the Corps on that. So that's why the connection comes together in the case of water pollution and wetlands.
Very interesting. That's always been a big surprise for a lot of people that the Army is playing such a significant role. In a practical perspective, then, if there was a successful campaign to get rid of the EPA, would that leave the Army Corps of Engineers to still be able to administer Clean Water Act, or at least on issues of pollution?
By its own criteria, which might or might not remain the same. But I think I'm not sure I want to play with that hypothetical. I don't think anybody is seriously about to eliminate the EPA. A couple of people have talked that up, starting with probably with Ronald Reagan, I suppose. That's not about to happen, I don't believe.
Okay. So, some of those concerns, certainly would play that role.
What is a concern that I think you're hinting at more broadly is the attempts by the courts to intervene. This was more a question with the West Virginia decision last year about air quality, in which the court held that EPA was assuming too broad a mandate and that they should not attempt to use the air quality regulations to address climate in the broad sense they were doing it without more specific congressional authority. And so there is a clear agenda among by some congressmen, many conservatives and so forth, to rein in federal regulatory agencies. One of the versions of that would be to reopen the question of what's called Chevron deference, which is a doctrine that I think was originated in the 1980s with the Supreme Court saying, well, we will defer to the agencies on matters in which they have congressional authority to make the decisions subsidiary to implementing their laws. And the alternative to that would be to say, well, judges can intervene and say, no, we'll answer those questions ourselves, which in my mind is, I mean, there are different legitimate points of view on this, but in my mind, that's probably a bad idea, because the EPA, the Congress has given authority to EPA to, Congress itself does not have the time or the expertise to write the details of regulations. And it's, you know, to try to get Congress to write the wetlands regulations and so forth would be a disaster. They don't have the time, they don't have the expertise to do it. So they have delegated that authority to the agencies, and to say that that then should be subject to question by the courts, and is to say that, well, we would have people who are judges are not, you know, experts on the science either. And they would, you know, so it's very likely be politicized by just by the views of or assumptions of the particular judges. I remember way back 20 or 30 years ago, there was a case in New York State about thermal discharges from nuclear power plants. And a judge ruled against the environmental proponents of regulating these things, because it turned out somebody heard him talking in a bar later. He was a former World War II veteran who knew something about air current mixing and assumed that the same held for water currents, and which was not the case. And if they had heard that in court, they could have challenged it. But it was, you get the judgments of judges on matters of scientific fact and these kinds of questions. It's risky. I mean, we have agencies with expertise, and they are held accountable for that expertise. They must provide a basis in, you know, a reasonable basis in fact for what they propose, and judges should, you know, should listen to them, should listen to the challenges to it from equally qualified scientists and economists and others. But to say that the judges should just substitute their judgment for the agencies, it would be a risky thing to do.
Yeah, David Kaiser, I want to bring you into this conversation as well, because the reference to the West Virginia case, I remember when that came up last year, the argument was the EPA was really kind of overstretching what the Clean Air Act had intended. But the Clean Water Act has always intended to protect wetlands, hasn't it? Wetlands protection has been a part of the Clean Water Act. It's been a part of the intention there. And the courts stepping in and defining what waters are protected, as opposed to the EPA making that decision, seems to be exactly what Pete's describing, is a group of judges that know much less about that question than, say, you know, the scientists and those who are implementing in places like both the EPA and the Corps of Engineers. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I mean, again, if you look to this connectivity report that EPA put out during the Obama administration, they reviewed something like over 1,000 peer-reviewed articles describing how water resources are very much hydrologically and ecologically connected across the United States. And so that's based on the best science in terms of thinking about how these things like wetlands that are nearby water resources, or again, intermittent ephemeral streams, play an important role in the broader discussion or the broader hydrologic network in the United States. It seems like, again, that's just kind of gone out the door, and it's not so much, and I'm not a legal scholar, but in reading the opinions of the court, they're not necessarily talking so much about the science, say, arguments over that report and the thousands of peer-reviewed articles that describe it, but instead are debating over what the term waters meant back in 1972, or what the term water means or waters means back in 1972.
Let me add to this. Go back to the actual decision that was made here. It was the Sackett decision was, on the one hand, the question, the basic question about whether the Sackett's property was properly considered a wetland subject to federal regulation. That was a unanimous decision that it was not, okay, including all three liberals as well as the rest of the ones. However, when Justice Alito went on to tackle this broader question of the what are the federally regulatable wetlands. The concurring opinion, which disagreed on that, was written by Justice Kavanaugh, one of the others who's generally considered a conservative, and it was, and all the liberals joined him in that, and in saying basically, what you're doing is not paying attention to the science, and it is substituting a simplistic dictionary definition of eliding together what waters are adjoining federal waters of the United States and those that are adjacent, but not necessarily adjoining it. Now, why does this matter? Well, think of the lower Mississippi, in which there's a set of levees all up and down the Mississippi, which separate the historic wetlands from the river. And they're an essential part of the flood control system for the Mississippi River. And yet they're not considered, you know, because of this thing, they have to be actually adjoining, you know, having a direct surface water connection. There's a strong argument that the court has ruled that they are now with outside federal protection, and which is kind of a, you know, you scratch your head kind of a decision.
And just adding to what Pete mentioned there too, I had referenced earlier a recent economics paper trying to measure the benefits of flood protection from wetlands. And I believe they find that the majority of the benefits or the majority of the values are actually wetlands that are fairly close, I think within something like 500 and 750 meters. But then it would be interesting to see, I mean, it'll be a very important question, like how many of those then are ruled out that are not necessarily going to be then under this new definition of Sackett of what would be waters of the United States.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the Clean Water Act, wetlands protection, and the Sackett versus EPA decision from the Supreme Court from this term with David Kaiser of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and Richard Pete Andrews from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Pete, you raised the issue first, though you and David both have raised this question about the way in which wetlands offer flood protection. But Pete, when you presented it, you talked about sort of draining wetlands and replacing them with a levee system. And so is there something inherently more beneficial at using a natural wetlands rather than trying to create, you know, a man-made system that's responsible for floodplains? Especially I'm asking this because I grew up on the Mississippi River and the levees were ever present. Are the levees worse than natural means of flood protection? Yeah.
Natural has many benefits. I mean, the original, many parts of the Mississippi were originally oxbows, which gradually formed over many centuries, and which, you know, when you get the floods that come down, they can capture those floods and diminish their force downstream. When you straighten the streams and put levees on them, it shoots that water downstream faster and causes worse floods downstream. And then, of course, levees only protect you up to a certain point. And with the increased rainfall we're seeing now, we've seen several times in the Mississippi Basin disastrous floods when the levees have been breached. So in that sense, yeah, I mean, it's a tough choice because people want to live and work near water and build cities near water and so forth, partly because it is a transportation route, but also because they just enjoy the benefits of waterside living. And but you are creating a worse flood risk when you do that.
And Pete, I'm curious, David, as well. I don't know this answer. This is where I would go and ask some of my ecologist friends or engineering friends or environmental science friends. But I'm curious as well for levees. I would assume that they don't have the same kind of filtering capabilities for filtering out nutrients or sediments or others. Is that correct?
Certainly. No, they don't. I mean, you're basically reclaiming wetlands for development or farming use. But you're sacrificing the ecological values of those lands, and as well as just the practical value of them for, you know, absorbing the occasional floods that come through.
Now, Pete, what immediately comes to mind here was in 2005, of course, the flooding of New Orleans. And there was a lot of conversation about how draining wetlands, replacing them with the levees, ended up, you know, obviously the levees breaking is the reason why the, you know, why New Orleans was flooded. Is that an example that you're talking about here?
Well, that in that case, it was a huge hurricane that caused the problem. And levees can only be built to withstand a certain level of attack on them. We hope that the current ones, my son and his family, three of our grandchildren live in New Orleans. So I have a very personal interest in hoping that levee holds. But, you know, the larger picture is, you know, Louisiana is losing enormous amounts of land to the sea, to subsidence, because of the withdrawal of oil from underneath it and so forth. And basically, you know, we're keeping the Mississippi going where the Mississippi doesn't want to go, making it take a left turn toward New Orleans rather than going where it would otherwise go. But no, the levee systems I was thinking about were not just those that protect a city directly like New Orleans, but ones all up and down the Mississippi, which essentially channelize it, you know, keep maintain it within a set of constrained banks rather than allowing it to expand and contract over, you know, surrounding lands that that are essentially water-based lands until you cut them off with a levee.
I'll ask David this first, and it's probably an unfair question, but I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. Big broad question about how much, whether it's wetlands protection, you know, with levees, or this represents humanity's desire to control nature, and one area where nature fights back pretty effectively are on floods, are on protection from water. Is it fair to say, I guess, broadly, this has very little to do with the Sackett decision and much more to do sort of broadly, that maybe one of the lessons here is the protection of the environment's real value is that when man fights nature, nature frequently wins?
I don't know if I'm well positioned to answer that question, Doug. But
probably
I,
an unfair question, but it was maybe, one that's on my mind.
Maybe one that I'll kind of spin. I'll spin that question just a little bit in terms of answering it. I also think that what's interesting here is that we've been also talking a lot about the, and I know I raised it as well, but the flood control benefits of the Clean Water Act. But what we think about here is that the Clean Water Act was really geared towards controlling or improving surface water quality in the United States. And so this was the oftentimes what we see with environmental policies and environmental regulations is that there are some of these really significant, important, maybe either unintended or co-benefits associated with the regulation that we should keep in mind. But I know that doesn't answer your question in particular, but spinning it in a little bit of a way in which I think that, again, coming back to this, that when we think about floods and we think about the purpose and the benefits of protecting the environment is that oftentimes we get a multitude of benefits from the environment that, you know, go away then when we no longer protect it, not just the ones that we're focused on, say, for, in this case, surface water quality, we're getting water quantity benefits as well.
Pete, I'm going to ask you the same unfair question, probably again, unfair because it's kind of a big, broader, more philosophical question, but same question, is protecting the environment just a recognition that nature's figured out a way to do things maybe better than man has?
Well, that's an easier way to answer the question. Okay. That's an easier question to answer that, you know, I mean, you don't ultimately win battles against natural processes. You can manage the environment to an extent, and you know you can create a levee that is, you know, supposed to hold up to certain forces if you understand your physics and geology and the, you know, the makings of it and so forth. But quite often we tend to manage the environment for particular immediate human purposes without attempting to understand the connections of those. Of those changes to other aspects of natural processes or into longer term natural processes that are out there. And so even today, we're making some progress in, for example, in raising infrastructure to, you know, in the face of sea level rise here and there and so forth. But you know, with it, that's there's only so much we can do on that, and it's costly to work against nature's processes and to try to hope that our solutions will hold up for a reasonable length of time. So it's we've learned, if we listen to our ecologists and other scientists who are working in this area, so that we understand better the interconnected and more complicated environmental, you know, natural processes involved, we'll be doing ourselves a favor as well by, you know, putting cities in appropriate places and designing infrastructures to, you know, if we're going to create costly infrastructures, let's at least put them in places and design them in ways that they are working with nature rather than against it. Now, at some points, you know, this human desires and economic forces, economic actors, we're going to say we want to do it anyway. I mean, there's I contrast the a lot of the rich people still building fancy houses out on the Outer Banks in North Carolina, even in the face of sea level rise, and just saying, well, if it hurricane takes it out, we'll just rebuild. And maybe they have the money to do that. And somebody else I know who's lived out there for generations with their family says, well, what my granddaddy always used to say is, yeah, you never take anything out on the banks that you're afraid to lose. Because the forces of nature are there and active.
No, absolutely. I just have a few minutes left. And so this will be sort of my last question for both of you. I'll start with David. The environmental activists, environmental interests have complained over the years that the last certainly 10, 12 years of the Supreme Court, perhaps even a longer trend, has really signaled a weakening of the EPA. And this Sackett decision certainly seems to suggest that the EPA has come out of this Supreme Court's docket weaker this year than it was before. Is it fair to say, ultimately, one of the lessons learned from all of this is that environmental protection broadly and the EPA specifically is being weakened, and it's a trend that's likely to continue?
So I'd say, to answer that question, Doug, I certainly think that it appears that the role for federal regulations in terms of protecting the environment certainly seems, or the EPA's role in protecting the environment certainly seems to have taken a hit, and will certainly, in my opinion, will contract quite a bit. I guess the question then, when you talk about environmental protection more broadly, will depend upon what states do in response. Now, I certainly wouldn't expect all 50 states to respond, to step in and fill the role of what the EPA is doing. However, if you look at during the Trump administration with the passage of the Navigable Waters Protection Rule, or in 2020, which was at that time, again, a contraction of the jurisdictional coverage of the Clean Water Act, you had something like along the lines, I think, about 20 states that sued to repeal the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. And I believe the state of California has already come out, maybe a few others as well, and have said that while Sackett is a disappointing decision for their state or for the U.S. as a whole, that it will not change how, say, California regulates wetlands and wetland development within the state. And so I think what you will likely see is much more of a patchwork of environmental regulations across the United States in terms of the protection of water resources that may vary depending on, say, whether or not you're in California versus Texas versus New Mexico or, say, Minnesota.
Yeah, yet another development in the U.S. of red state, blue state seems to be that suggestion. Well, Pete Andrews, you have about 90 seconds.
I want to give a slightly different take on that because, you know, first of all, we don't know yet how the EPA and the Corps will interpret this decision and what they think they can do to maintain wetland protection in the face of it. I mean, so we've still got that to wait for. You know, we had a lot of doomsday kind of reports after the West Virginia decision on air, and actually it took away, unfortunately, one of the most cost-effective tools that EPA might have used to protect against climate change. The way they had designed that was quite clever economically, but it didn't keep them from, you know, doing other things to protect against climate change. And Congress immediately turned around and wrote legislation that said, yeah, EPA does have authority to regulate climate change. So I don't want to give up on EPA yet. And I also, at the same time, we've got to really worry about the difference among not just all red states and blue states. There are some red states that are pretty conservation oriented, but you know, the things like the North Carolina legislature and this just handcuffing itself to the EPA regulations and keeping its, you know, just not looking carefully at its own wetland regulation is how broadly that will occur across, for example, the South, where there are a lot of important wetlands. Good for California, but I hope we can get some wetland protection in the South as well.
Yeah, and I think the essential component here is, first of all, voting matters. The voters matter. When they demand wetlands protection, state legislatures are much more likely to respond to that. And at the end of the day, building political will for environmental protection, I think, is probably the most essential tool that we all have. So thank you, you know, very much. And our panel today has been David Kaiser. He's professor in the Department of Resource Economics in the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the co-author of The Low But Uncertain Measured Benefits of U.S. Water Quality Policy, Consequences of the Clean Water Act and the Demand for Water Quality, and Economic Effects of Environmental Crises, Evidence from Flint, Michigan. And Richard Pete Andrews, who is the faculty fellow of the Institute for the Environment and professor emeritus in the Department of Public Policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the author of Managing the Environment, Managing Ourselves, A History of American Environmental Policy. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.